You are listening to the Human Rights Podcast, hosted by the Irish Center for Human Rights at the University of Galway. This is a platform for dialogue and debate on issues related to human rights and international law. I am Julia Collins, and on today's episode of the Human Rights Podcast, we will be joined by Claire Ration. Together, we will be talking about the situation of unaccompanied minors in Europe and the role of the UNCRC in providing protection. In my recent work with refugees in Canada before, and what I've learned in my undergrad and LLM caught my interest to talk about unaccompanied children. Before chatting with Claire, I wanted to give you an introduction on who are unaccompanied children and what protection challenges they face. Also, I want to introduce you to human rights regarding the CRC. First of all, who are unaccompanied children? We often hear these terms in the news, but what does it mean? The UNCRC defines the term unaccompanied children are children who have been separated from both parents and other relatives and are not being cared for by an adult who by law or custom is responsible for doing so. In the year of 2022, according to UNICEF, about 21,145 are estimated in Europe. As there are many unaccompanied children coming to Europe, there are protection challenges the countries taking them face. In General Comment Number 6 in Paragraph 7, it is stated that unaccompanied minors are among the most vulnerable groups of refugees seeking protection in Europe. They come from diverse countries, including Syria, Ukraine, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Sudan, just to name a few. They may often have entered conflict or be victims of human trafficking or experience other human rights violations. They often travel via irregular and hazardous routes to reach their destination. Upon arrival, they are often accommodated in reception centers, and these present their own challenges. We will hear more about this from Claire. According to UNICEF, all children on the move are vulnerable to abuse and other grave forms of violence during and after their journeys. More than one child is estimated to die daily along the perilous Central Mediterranean route from North Africa to Italy. They may not have identification documents and may be disbelieved in their age. We will learn more about that later too. The treatment of unaccompanied migrant children has become a pressing human rights issue in recent years. These children face unique challenges and vulnerabilities, and their rights must be protected under international law. While there are a range of applicable instruments, in this episode we will examine the rights of unaccompanied migrant children under the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, short CRC, focusing on their specific rights in the context of reception. Some facts about the UNCRC. The UNCRC provides a legal framework for protecting children's rights. According to the UN Treaty Database, it is the most widely ratified treaty worldwide. It has four key principles, which are non-discrimination, the best interest of the child, the right to life, survival and development, and respect for the views of the child. The UNCRC is overseen and monitored by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child through their general comment and key decisions. This is a really important issue, so we are delighted to have Claire, who has done a lot of work on this. Claire has been a PhD researcher with the Irish Center for Human Rights. Her research focuses broadly on reception conditions for unaccompanied migrant children in Europe and the right to non-discrimination in this context. Welcome, Claire. After introducing the UNCRC and Claire in her research field, let's explore the rights of unaccompanied migrant children under the Convention on the Rights of the Child. What are these rights of unaccompanied migrant children under the CRC, and what are their specific rights in the context of reception?
Claire. Well, Julia, delighted to be here. Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, just to go through the rights, as you mentioned, under the CRC, so the Convention on the Rights of the Child So this means that every country in the world, with the exception of the United States, within all of those states, all children are rights bearers under this convention, and may avail of the full range of rights. So that's irrespective of migration or other status. So some rights are more relevant to certain groups of children, of course. And so for unaccompanied children in the context of reception, for example, the right to non-discrimination, as you pointed out, the kind of the core or overarching principles of the Convention on the Rights of the Child are of particular relevance, including the best interests of the child, the right to life, survival and development, and the right of the child to be heard. They're core basic rights. So when we think about unaccompanied children in reception, we want to consider a child rights-based approach. So that's more of a holistic approach to reception for this group. And a holistic approach views all convention rights as interdependent and interrelated and indivisible. So rights, for example, though, just to highlight a few that may be of particular significance in this context, would include Article 22 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So that's on the right of asylum-seeking and refugee children within the jurisdiction of a state party to receive appropriate protection and humanitarian assistance in the enjoyment of applicable rights set forth. So both in the CRC in that case and in other international human rights and humanitarian instruments to which the state is also a party. So for example, any of the other international human rights conventions or treaties. Article 20 then stipulates that any child temporarily or permanently deprived of his or her family environment. So we shouldn't forget either the unaccompanied child's rights to a standard of living adequate for the minor's physical, mental, spiritual, moral, and social development under Article 27, one of the CRC, or Article 20, which sets down that any child temporarily or permanently deprived of his or her family environment, which is, of course, specifically referencing children in situations such as unaccompanied children without their families, they shall be entitled provided by the state. So that's essentially kind of setting down the right to a legal guardian for this group of children. So when they reach their destination, when they get to a receiving state, children have a right to be looked after, to the right to assistance, and primarily a very important safeguard is that they are appointed a legal guardian almost immediately. The provision I spoke about there in Article 27 is that children have a standard, that children have a right to a standard of living adequate to their physical, mental, and spiritual, moral, and social development. So that kind of is seen to supersede even all other rights because it's so integral to the child's right to life. And again, this is an obligation that is imposed on all states, irrespective of the child's migration status. And I would argue that it's more important than the material support that's currently recognised in regional law and reception, which I'll speak a little bit about in a second. But just with regard to the CRC, as just to finally note as well, a critical provision for unaccompanied children is Article 37, and that's on the right of the child to be free from torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, and of course, on detention as a last resort. As I just mentioned, children are also addressed in the Reception Conditions Directive of the EU's Common European Asylum System, where the most basic and enforceable rights for unaccompanied children include material reception, such as housing, food, and clothing provided in kind, or also they're entitled to be provided with by states' financial allowances or in vouchers or a combination of the three and a daily expenses allowance. So, under this instrument, unaccompanied children are recognised as a vulnerable group with special reception needs.
Thanks for introducing the rights of unaccompanied children in reception facilities. Are these rights implemented or upheld by states at policy or operational levels of implementation?
There are often issues with implementation, so states often failing to treat the unaccompanied migrant child as a child first and a migrant second. So even in cases such as the Reception Conditions Directive, the recast instrument, it ostensibly takes a child rights-based approach to this group, and it incorporates provisions of the CRC, but you do see in the implementing policy guidance that there's often inconsistencies with respect to children's rights or an overemphasis on particular rights such as the best interests of the child without detailed guidance as how to implement it. There's also very, very little mention of Article 2 on non-discrimination in this implementing guidance. And then in practice, European states at present, most particularly since 2015, seem to be very preoccupied with the exclusion of unaccompanied children from rights. So reception systems, as we've seen over the past few years, that were already on the brink due to a failure by governments to address the fact that they were not fit for purpose, are now crumbling under the pressure of increased forced migration and refugee movements. And unfortunately for unaccompanied children, there are reports emerging from many member states that such children are now homeless and destitute, living in squats in cities like Brussels, and then in informal settlements and camps on the Greek islands, just to name but a few.
Now we have been discussing the rights of unaccompanied children under the UNCRC, with the specific context in reception facilities and their implementation. Going on to my next question regarding human rights violations by EU member states. How does that look like in Spain and Greece in the context of reception of unaccompanied children?
In January 2020, I visited the Phthai hotspot on the Greek island of Samos. And at that time, it was estimated that there were approximately 8,000 people living there, so 12 times the capacity of the then Reception and Identification Centre, which has changed since. But over 7,000 of those people were living in a makeshift camp in the forest behind the centre. And it was referred to as residents, by residents even, as the jungle. So just a month before, under its Rule 39, the European Court of Human Rights had granted interim measures to five unaccompanied minors living on the outskirts of the camp. And that was a recognition that there was a real risk of irreparable harm occurring and an attempt to prevent harms arising under Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, the prohibition on torture or inhuman and degrading treatment. So the living conditions there constitute a gross violation of that Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, and there was a lack of access to medical services, security, food, and adequate hygiene facilities. So when I witnessed the conditions that gave rise to this gross violation, I was really shocked, actually. There was rubbish everywhere, and inhabitants had to climb steep, muddy hillsides with few or no paths. During the winter, many people were wearing flip-flops. The children that played on cliff edges had scabies or impetigo and exhibited signs of trauma. So we had a humanity crew, which is an NGO that works on the islands, and they taught us how to recognize signs of trauma in children just as we were going through the camps. There was a complete lack of sanitation, and people were keen to show us the makeshift toilets that they had built with one communal clean water tap that they had to queue for hours to use. There was only one doctor for 8,000 people. So there was a great reliance on voluntary organisations for everything, from the provision of food and hygiene packs to mental and physical health services. So apart from the lack of humanity exhibited, both Greece and the EU were contravening their legal obligations towards unaccompanied children under international and regional law. And the situation in Greece has actually deteriorated since then. But unaccompanied children are supposed to be recognised, identified as children, and they're supposed to be entitled then to their child-specific rights. And unfortunately, in many European states, this just is not the case at the moment.
Thank you for your input, Claire, on the human rights violations by EU member states such as Spain and Greece in the context of reception for unaccompanied children. This leads me to my next question. Do unaccompanied children experience discrimination? Is this recognized by the Committee on the Rights of the Child? And what advice, guidance does the committee give to state parties, to the CRC, on the treatment of this group?
Yeah, so I mean, I would suggest that rights violations are linked to discrimination at all stages of reception for unaccompanied children. So whether it's the initial reception stage or children in situations of prolonged reception, such as the situation I just mentioned there in the Thai in Samos. And children can also experience discrimination when they're refused access to the territory of the state to have their best interests assessed. So there's many ways that states can violate the prohibition on discrimination in Article 2 of the CRC. But however, when considering claims of unaccompanied children in reception facilities, for example, in Spain, the committee often concludes that complaints under Article 2 to one in particular are manifestly unfounded, and they focus on elements of the complaint that allege violations of other provisions of the CRC. So endurance jurisprudence, recent jurisprudence, for example, in the complaints against Spain, unaccompanied children who have been subjected to rights violations during the age determination procedures often complain of discrimination and link their complaints to the actions of the authorities, who, for example, might fail to accept their identity documents as authentic or fail to consider the best interests of the child at all stages of procedures, often subjecting unaccompanied children to invasive age assessments and then detaining them. So children who complain of discrimination in this context usually can substantiate their claim of discrimination, but it's usually not examined further. So the committee will find violations of the best interests of the child and the right to of the child to receive special protection and assistance provided by the state instead. And unfortunately, these findings are generally ignored in the case of Spain particularly. So, I mean, there is a discrepancy between the findings of the committee with respect to discrimination and their advice to states in their general comment number 6, and also in their joint general comments with the Committee on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Their Families, which advises states to grant unaccompanied children access to the territory of the state, and to respect and ensure all of the rights in the Convention to each child, irrespective of whether they are asylum-seeking, refugee, or migrant child, or whether they're accompanied by their parents or not.
One important aspect of the reception process of unaccompanied children in Europe is the determination of their age. It is common for authorities to assess the age of these children to determine their eligibility of certain protections and services. However, there has been a growing concern about the challenges and biases associated with age assessments, leading to the emergence of what is often referred to as the culture of disbelief. Turning back to you, Claire, what would you say? How does the culture of disbelief impact on unaccompanied children in Europe?
Sure, yeah. So the age assessments that are crucial to the identification of an individual as a child where their age is in doubt are typically carried out in an ad hoc manner. So there's an illiberal application of the benefit of the doubt principle in practice. So the culture of disbelief is a really serious issue where authorities fail to believe unaccompanied children about their age. So there's this kind of pervasive what has been termed a culture, and that's very entrenched in EU member states and the UK. It's very widespread, and it's even been described as a structural issue by the Refugee Studies Centre in Oxford. And it's, you know, children, sometimes unaccompanied children lack documentation And in other times, they can present documentation to the authorities, but the authorities will refuse to believe that their claims that they are children. So you could argue that this is for a variety of reasons, but the outcomes for children, particularly where they're unaccompanied, is they're very, very detrimental. First of all, they're usually channeled into adult procedures. So depending on the state where they're in, they may be subject to deportation rather than being referred to a guardianship system. And then in other states, again, it varies widely. Unaccompanied children who are disbelieved about their age will be detained. And, obviously that contravenes Article 37 of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but there are rights violations associated with serious impact on the physical and psychological well-being of children. I could give you an example. There was a very recent case before the European Court of Human Rights, and it's called Darbo and Camara versus Italy. But so the applicant was an unaccompanied Ghanaian child, and he's declared himself a minor at his first point of contact with national authorities and asserted that the decision maker had clearly expressed doubts as to his credibility and the credibility of the information provided. So he only had one interview and submitted in that interview that he'd been treated with open suspicion and bias. So this had kind of compounded the stress that he had experienced following his journey. And then after that, he was moved to an adult reception facility where he remained for almost 5 months following an age assessment, which wrongly established that he was an adult male of 18 years. So during this time, his claim for international protection was not examined and a vulnerability assessment was not conducted. None of the safeguards in relation to initial reception or age assessments for unaccompanied children were adhered to. So the European Court concluded, among other things, that, the age of a person is a means of personal identification. And so it's so integral to unaccompanied children to be believed about their age because all of the rights that they're entitled to are derived from his or her minor status. So therefore, when a child is wrongly identified as an adult, serious measures in breach of his or her rights may be taken. And it's often the actions of the national authorities, but they're acting on behalf of the state that leads to these kind of violations. And the court in this case linked it potentially to the state's interest in foiling attempts to circumvent immigration rules on the protection of unaccompanied children, which then led to a deprivation of the applicant's rights in these cases, in this case even. So the court finally held that the principle of presumption of minor age or the liberal application of the benefit of the doubt is deemed to be an inherent element of protection of the right to respect for private life of an unaccompanied migrant child who is claiming to be a child. And that right arises under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights as well. So there's quite a lot of crossover parallels between cases before UNCRC and the European Court of Human Rights in that respect.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
We've just learned that the UNCRC has a great impact on how to protect the right of children in general, but also what impact it has on unaccompanied children. And when it comes to the situation with reception facilities, there could be much more done. We learned that children today sometimes end up in facilities for adults, and they're not treated how they should be treated. And thank you, Claire, for being here today. And yeah.
Thank you so much, Julia. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have been listening to the Human Rights Podcast. The podcast is produced by staff and students at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway and supported by the University Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. This episode was produced by Julia Collins and Claire Aitchen.